is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, October 17th, 2019. I'm Buster Olney. Our producer every day is Troy Farkas. And Troy, no baseball on Wednesday, as expected. We had the rain out at Yankee Stadium. Game 4 pushed back to today. How did you spend your Wednesday without a baseball game?
Well, unfortunately, it was very rainy, so I couldn't do most of the things I normally do when I have free time. I usually go for like a long walk at night in Bristol, which isn't the safest idea, but I couldn't do that yesterday, so I just kind of hung back, did some writing and reading, and that was my night.
Man, what were you reading? Were you reading up on the Great Depression?
No, I'm currently reading one of my favorite authors, Paulo Coelho, a book called Hippie. You should check that out.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's the inspiration for that?
He's one of my favorite writers. He writes a lot of books about kind of, you know, your personal journeys. Usually a lot of his books are about a couple of people traveling the world, finding themselves. They're very spiritual in nature. It's my kind of scene, Buster.
Yeah, so you're kind of self-help books are your thing?
No. They're not self-help books. They're just inspiring. The one I'm reading right now is a love story, and, you know, I love a good love story.
Yeah, especially when you're in the friend zone, right?
All right, that's enough out of you. Let's talk baseball.
Let's talk baseball. All right. Yesterday, because there was no ball game, there were conference calls arranged with both managers in the American League. A.J. Hinch spoke with reporters, and he announced that he will go with Zach Greinke in Game 4 tonight, Justin Verlander in Game 5 on Friday night at Yankee Stadium. Both of them will be on full rest. Yankees manager Aaron Boone will start Masahiro Tanaka tonight. And then likely, very likely, said James Paxton in Game 5. Here's A.J. Hinch talking about the benefits of a postponed game.
It gives everybody a day off, kind of an opportunity to collect ourselves before Game 4. It changes our pitching a little bit. How beneficial it is probably easier to answer after I see how guys perform and how the pitching plays out. But I don't know, I guess it's kind of a wait and see. But it does solidify who we start in Game 4 and Game 5 without having to go to a bullpen game.
Yeah, I think he was being polite. I think it's clear that this potentially benefits the Astros. He talked about how it wasn't hard to decide who would start Game 4.
You know, it was our plan. If it happened, it's Zach's normal day. He was going to pitch on Thursday, no matter what game number it was. JV on regular rest in Game 5. The sooner that we can use, you know, our best pitchers, the better for us. It was an easy decision.
Yankees manager Aaron Boone talked about his rotation.
As far as rotation goes, we'll be Tanaka tomorrow in Game 4 with likely Paxton then in Game 5, and then we'll see where we're at from there. Command and the ability to ultimately command, you know, your repertoire of pitches. So in a starter's case, typically we're talking three or more pitches, you know, and Masa clearly has that and the ability to put the ball where he wants, the ability to not make any kind of a moment or start bigger or less than it is. But having that ability to kind of really focus on pitch to pitch, and I think the guys that do that the best give themselves the best chance to be successful, and Masa's clearly demonstrated the ability to do that.
He talked about Giancarlo Stanton's status.
That'll be another conversation. Even though G hasn't been able to go yet, I did view him as the potential option off the bench in a hitting situation if we like something. So I don't look at it as we're entirely 24-man right now. I do believe we have his bat off the bench right now, and whether a situation for that arises, we'll see. But we'll continue to evaluate this as smartly as we can moving forward.
On the conference call, he strongly defended the play of Gary Sanchez, his struggling catcher, especially when talking about Sanchez's defense during the course of the year, and indicated again that Sanchez will play in Game 4 despite his struggles at the plate. As expected, the Angels announced the hiring of Joe Maddon as their manager. A source told ESPN's Jesse Rogers that Maddon will get a 3-year deal worth somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 to $15 million total. Tim Kirkchin was on SportsCenter with Kevin Negandhi talking why Joe Maddon is a good fit for the Angels.
I think Joe Maddon is the perfect fit. He's still a really good manager, and he will change the culture there. He does embrace sabermetrics and all the young things that happen in the game today, and yet he's an old soul and a great teacher at heart. And I believe the Angels have gone a little bit too far in the analytics department, and I think he's there to bring them back.
And, of course, there are questions moving forward about the Angels under a new manager vis-a-vis what's going on with the Tyler Skaggs investigation. Of course, the tragic death during the season of Skaggs involving opioids which he got from an Angels employee, according to Outside the Lines. Tim was asked about how Madden will handle the delicate Skag situation.
I've never met a more well-spoken manager, a more knowledgeable manager, or a smarter manager than Joe Madden. No one will be able to handle a difficult situation like this better than him. He's also the master of deflecting negative attention of any kind away from his players so his players can play. So when this comes up, and it's going to come up a lot, Joe Madden out in front will be able to diffuse things and take things on because he's able to handle that because, again, he went to college, studied English. He knows what he's doing in front of people.
And before we lead off with ESPN Radio's Chris Singleton and talk to him about Madden and the hiring and Game 4 coming up tonight, you know how they always say the best offense is a good defense? Well, that's especially true when it comes to the fuel you put in your car. It's time to help keep your engine running like new. Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline is engineered to defend against four main engine threats: gunk, wear, corrosion, and friction. It's our most advanced fuel ever, protecting your engine like a 7-run first inning protected the lead for the Washington Nationals. Like starting rotations, not all premium fuels are the same. Now that's fuel for thought, and if you're a Fuel Rewards member, you save at least 5 cents per gallon at every fill-up with gold status. Not a member? Download the Fuel Rewards app or go to fuelrewards.com to join and never pay full price for gas again. In engines that continuously use Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline. Chris Singleton is part of ESPN Radio's broadcast team on the American League Championship Series, working with our friend Dan Shulman. And Singy, a rainout on Wednesday as we expected. What did you do during the day? An unexpected day off.
Oh, man, cabin fever, Buster. I was mulling around the room, got some green tea over at Starbucks, walked around a little bit, had breakfast at like 2 a.m. I mean, not 2 a.m., 2 p.m., because I typically don't eat until after 12 or 1. So, but I like breakfast. It's my favorite meal. So, obviously, in New York, you can get breakfast any time of the day. So, that might have been the highlight of the day. But finally forced myself to get a workout in, got outside a little bit in the rain, hung out with some of the crew a little bit last night, and then watched some C-SPAN last night. fascinating stuff. And then I got a good night's sleep, and here I am with you.
Well, I appreciate you joining us, and I'll tap into your expectations moving forward. You asked me before we got started, do you think that we're going to go back to Houston for games 6 and 7? My guess is, objectively, I say no. What do you think?
I think we are. I think the Yankees have, really good chance of winning tonight and evening the series up. So I think we're going to be back there and making that Saturday morning day of travel and doing the game that night.
Yeah, so I was in the Yankees clubhouse after games 2 and 3, and man, the expressions on the faces of the hitters, you could see it, where they felt like, man, did we miss an opportunity. In game 2, it wasn't vintage Justin Verlander. They had some traffic on the bases, and they could not score. In game 3, Gerrit Cole, a career-high 5 walks. Again, traffic. But in the end, the Yankees lose those 2 games, 16 runners left on base, and just 3 runs scored. And you could see in the Yankees' faces, hitters, like, man, did we miss opportunities. And in a 7-game series, there are not a lot of those. So it'll be very interesting to see how they bounce back. What are you seeing in the Yankees' hitters so far?
Yeah, I agree. And, we're watching the games there together and experiencing it. But the big knock, that's the one, that's where you feel like it's lacking outside of, game one where they put 7 up on the board. But again, you're facing Zach Greinke, not Justin Verlander or Gerrit Cole. But, on the flip side of that, giving some credit to the pitchers. I mean, Verlander and Cole, they're going to finish in the, one of them's going to win. It's probably going to be Gerrit Cole, the Cy Young Award, but they're going to finish in the top 3. And giving them some credit as well, that's what great pitchers do. You got great pitching up against
you know, really good hitting, and they find a way to get out of jams. They, you know, even some of the walks in Game 3 with Gerrit Cole, and like, oh, man, he walked five guys. But I think Gerrit Cole, you know, some of those walks are intentional in terms of where am I at in the count? I'm not giving in here. I've got confidence because I can get the swing and miss. Then I'm not going to worry about, you know, adding a base runner as much as the average guy would. So I think some of that is a little bit calculated, but obviously, you know, with respect on both sides, it could have gone, you know, either way with, you know, a swing and a big hit and some plating some runs for the Yankees, but they just weren't able to come through. And regardless of who's out there, I'll say as a, you know, former hitter and position player, yeah, that really rubs you the wrong way when you had opportunities. And in this game where it's not just, hey, I got to barrel up something against Gerrit Cole, I just got to have a competitive at bat. Man, if I dunk something over the shortstop's head or it gets into, you know, it's pulled down the line, whatever it may be, just something that sort of, you know, springs things open, and they just couldn't get that hit.
So we've talked the last couple days about how the rainout, in my opinion, could really work to the Astros' advantage because the Yankees are so reliant on their bullpen, and now they're in a position where if the series goes seven games, Aaron Boone would have to use his relievers potentially four consecutive days during the regular season. The Yankees never used a single reliever more than two consecutive days, so they could face a stress test there. That all said, a really interesting X factor for tonight's game, and I want to ask you about because you've been on the field for these type of situations. We had the rain pass through yesterday, but the weather in some respects may be even worse for tonight. It's supposed to be super windy. I was looking at the forecast, gusts up to 40 miles per hour. The temperature is going to be in the mid-50s. The real feel is going to be somewhere in the range of 43 degrees. And you've got two pitchers on the mound, Zach Greinke, Masahiro Tanaka, who are going to be heavily reliant on secondary pitches. So with crazy conditions, you know, the wind blowing like crazy, you know, a lot of stress on the two pitchers, what's your sense of, you know, which of these guys might benefit from that or maybe the hitters benefit from it? What's your read on it?
Well, let me start with, you know, the closest to home for me and as a center fielder, gusty winds, no bueno, man. That stinks. Like when you're out there in the outfield and you're trying to position yourself and your corner outfielders from, you know, pitch to pitch and batter to batter and not really, you know, super predictable on what the wind's doing, but you know it's affecting the baseball. So there can be a little bit of panic there at times for an outfielder. But for the pitchers, I guess you'd say, you know, who's able to keep, you know, the ball on the ground a little more, that helps. Unfortunately, neither one of these guys is bringing power in terms of, you know, power fastballs, because when you have the chillier temperatures and when you talk about, you know, a lot of these right-handed hitters and being able to, you know, get in with fastballs, you know, a little elevated, a little bit in to make them uncomfortable. When you have the cold temperatures, you know, that's not where hitters feel real comfortable being crowded and the potential to get jammed. So I would say, you know, Tanaka, because of the split finger, because he's, you know, pitching down in the zone more often, that perhaps he has a chance of keeping the ball on the ground more and allowing, you know, the infielders to make plays or even, you know, getting some swings and misses, you know, in this weather. But yeah, it's going to be a big contrast, I'd say, from what we're expecting in Houston. And, you know, I know you don't think we're going to get there. I think we might, you know, we're going to get there. But 90 degrees, you know, in Houston on Saturday compared to what we're going to have tonight. So going to be pretty tough there. But we'll see if any of these pitchers are able to take advantage of that. I think if anyone, you know, Zach Greinke is a little better at moving the ball around and changing up some looks. But still, you know, Greinke's thing, man, his fastball, slugging off of his fastball, you know, in that first game was like over 900. So, you know, they were tattooing his fastball when he was coming in with it. And his strength to me is adding and subtracting velocity off of his secondary pitches.
And I'd say this, since Tanaka's joined the Yankees, you've always heard he seems to be completely unflappable. Like, I feel like he's one of those guys, if you put him out in a blizzard or if you put him out when it's 140 degrees, you're going to get the same expression and he's going to feel confident that he's going to figure out a way to get it done. One of his former teammates from Japan told me a story about his last year when he was pitching in Japan, how he started game six of the what their version of the World Series. And the next day, Tanaka came in and before game seven, and the teammate could tell, like, he was getting ready to pitch in the relief. And he looked at him and said, "Are you crazy? You think you're going to pitch in relief?" And Tanaka looked at him and said, "Of course I am." And he wound up being on the mound at the end of that game. That's his personality. Like, it seems like, and I think that's part of the reason why Aaron Boone started him game one, because Tanaka's not bothered by anything. I don't know Zach Greinke as well as I do Tanaka, but I feel like in those weird conditions tonight, that's the type of guy you want on the mound.
Yeah, and what's so awesome about that, I have been, like, just really kind of in awe watching Tanaka, because you look at, okay, you know, guys' regular season numbers and ERA, Buster, you know, 4.45. Then you come in and you look at his postseason numbers, you know, looking at, like, his last start, 1.54, six postseason starts. Guys just nails. But because of perhaps the difference, you know, in, you know, background, where he's from and language and everything else, it's harder for people like you and I to get a feel for, you know, who he is. Obviously, let's just contrast that, right? Max Scherzer. We don't even have to talk to Max Scherzer to, like, get a feel for what he's all about, because you can just see it in his expressions and everything else that he's doing. Whereas with Tanaka, you don't know, like, there's just this calm, you know, quietness. You don't know what's in there. And he doesn't, you know, show really any emotion when he's out pitching. So it's hard to really tell. But when you see this, like, assassin, if you will, in the postseason, where he just goes out and says, "Oh, yeah, you know what? So my home road splits during the regular season, 3-1-0 at home. Oh, no, don't pitch him on the road because it's a 6.05 ERA. Well, he goes on the road and he shoves, you know? And it's like, you're just, it's really impressive when you see a pitcher or a player that takes their game quietly to another level and a high level when it matters most, and there's no hype and there's nothing around it. They just go out and they're just a silent assassin, and they go back in and wait for the next time to pitch. So really impressed with him. Here's something interesting, Buster. Zach Greinke, he has the only place ballpark in the American League East that he has ever won a ball game is in Toronto. He's never won a start in Tropicana Field, Camden Yards, Fenway Park, or Yankee Stadium. How about that?
Well, and I think I know this. This was part of their evaluation when there have been opportunities when Zach Greinke has been on the market. The Yankees have passed on him for various reasons, and that was one of those. The question about, you know, how he would fit in the American League East with the stronger lineups. That's interesting, though. I didn't know that number. Cindy, before you go, I want to ask you about the Angels hiring of Joe Maddon. I like the fit a lot. I think, you know, the things that you always heard about him with the Cubs was, well, that team over the years in recent seasons, they didn't have the sense of urgency. I don't think that would ever be a factor on the Angels because, A, Mike Trout, their best player, goes at it all the time. Like, he plays hard all the time. The second thing is, there's no reason for them to be complacent because they haven't won anything in a long time. I think he's a really good fit there with the personality. I think he and Trout will hit it off. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's going to be good both ways. You know, Joe Maddon just, you know, being reunited with the organization where he spent so much time and is, you know, like his home. And I'm sure he still considers in a lot of ways home, even though some of the faces have changed. Owner's still the same. Myself, best player of this, you know, generation, clearly, and Trout also, I'm sure, were admiring from a distance what Joe did, not just in Chicago, but even in Tampa. So that's going to be neat. But I just hope that Joe Maddon will, that we will see more of a sort of sense of urgency with him over the next couple of years with this ball club. But again, it's going to come down to the moves that are made. They got to add some pitching. It's not like he can walk in there and transform that roster where they're at right now into a playoff team. I mean, you know, management's going to have to do some work this offseason and bring it all together. And I know you've talked about this till, you know, blue in the face, as well as others have. You can't waste Mike Trout's best years and have best player in the game and you're not in October. He's been in October, what, once? When they got swept by the Kansas City Royals? You just can't have that. You've got to put the players around him. You've got the manager. You've got to add the players, and particularly the pitching, to make it happen. But I hope that all that comes together so that the Angels can be relevant again, because, you know, there was a time where it was fun, the Mike Socia years, and looking at how – I remember how it's like, oh, man, this American League team, they play the game of, like, the National League, and they move runners, they do all this stuff, but they're in the AL – and it was just really cool, and it was a fun story. And that has just, you know, really waned over the years. So even bigger than Mike Trout or Joe Maddon, you know, you want the Angels to be relevant again just for the good of baseball.
No doubt about it. You know, to see Trout on the big stage in October would be really cool. And you and I both know this, is that if he got that opportunity again, he would kill it, as he does at the All-Star game every year. All right, Cingy, I will see you at the ballpark. Have fun today.
All right, sounds good. Thanks.
Numbers game.
Sarah Lang's a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, I was just talking with Chris Singleton about how there are just so many interesting X factors could be at play tonight. You've got Tanaka and Greinke, and on the surface level, you look at two pitchers who throw a lot of off-speed pitches. But according to forecast, gusts up to 40 miles per hour.
Oh, my gosh.
The wind chill factor in the low 40s. And I'm not smart enough, and I didn't play in the big league, so I can't tell you how that might affect the two pitchers. But based on all that, what's your prediction for tonight?
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know about that. Good luck to you guys at the ballpark, first of all. I know you'll be up in the booth, luckily, but, God, it gets cold. That makes me concerned for Zach Greinke's best pitch. That makes me concerned for those 70-mile-an-hour EFIS pitches and those pitches that are under 70 miles an hour, because I was not a physics major or anything near it, but – my understanding of physics tells me that it's going to be a lot harder for those pitches to go the way he wants them to if the wind is going sideways like that. I was honestly going to pick the Astros, but now I'm not so sure. Tanaka's so good at home. I might have to rethink that one. I do think the Astros are going to win the series here. I just think that with the rain out and everything, that I think we talked about this, but
yeah,
that before we knew it was going to happen, we talked about it on Monday with the possibility. I think that favors the Astros, but tonight now feels like it could be a Yankees night.
All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three.
Number three is 71%. So with the Astros up 2-1 in the ALCS heading into tonight's game four, in all best-of-seven postseason series, teams taking a 2-1 lead have gone on to win 98 of 139 times, which is that 71%. And when series in the current 2-3-2 format have been tied 1-1, those teams winning Game 3 on the road have gone on to take the series 28 of 38 times, which is 74% if the Astros were to win it. And here's what to keep in mind moving forward if they were to win today. In those 2-3-2 best-of-seven series, teams to be up 3-1 heading into a Game 5 on the road have won those series 85% of the time. And if the Yankees win, teams in this format to be tied 2-2 heading into Game 5 at home have won those series 24 of 55 times, or just 44%. So that's why I'm still thinking Astros in the series overall.
Number 2.
Number 2 is 19-31. So the Nationals were 19-31 through 50 games this year, and now they're headed to the World Series. That's the second worst record for any team through 50 games for a team to win the pennant, behind only the 2005 Astros, who were 18-32. And of course, they went on to lose in the World Series, which is something the Nationals are going to try to flip the script on. One thing working against them, though, since the LCS became best of seven in 1985, eight teams before this year have swept an LCS, and only one of those teams went on to win the World Series, the 1995 Braves. and those teams have fared very poorly in the World Series games. The only one of the ones to lose to even get to a seven-game World Series was the 2014 Royals.
Number one.
Number one is 21, so I love this so much. So Juan Soto turns 21 on October 25th, and that's going to be World Series Game 3 in Washington, D.C., the first World Series game there since 1933. And I think we've discussed on this podcast how much I love birthdays, not just my own, but everybody's birthdays. So when the Nationals clinched, I remember when Juan Soto came up, I remember looking up last year, oh, you know, we do a lot of notes with age, right? And okay, he's 19 last year, he's 19. And I would always check, okay, when's his birthday so that if it's going to be in the season, I know how to modify the notes. And I was like, oh, it's in late October, we're fine, this isn't going to be an issue. So that crept back into my head, hey, he's going to play a World Series game on his birthday. So there have been three players in postseason history to homer on their birthdays. Colton Wong on his 25th birthday in 2015 NLDS Game 2. Evan Longoria on his 28th birthday in 2013 ALDS Game 3, and Willie Akins on his 26th in 1980 World Series Game 1, and he hit two home runs. So, I mean, that's the list that, in my mind, Juan Soto is going to be looking to join in that very emotional, very exciting Game 3 in D.C.
Yeah, that'll be fun to watch. And thankfully, when they win the World Series, or if they win the World Series, he'll be able to have a beer legally.
Yes.
Before you go, yesterday we heard Aaron Boone, the Yankees manager, talk in the conference call about Giancarlo Stanton's status. It's clear that they don't know exactly where he stands. It's got to the point, Sarah, where if I were in the Yankee shoes, I don't have access to all the medical information, but if I got that feeling that Stanton might not be available today or tomorrow, I'm at the point where I'd be like, you know what? Activating Mike Tauchman, and we're sitting Stanton down. Not only because I think Tauchman was very underrated in how he helped the team, but I like having the left-handed hitter. I like having a guy who can play all three outfield spots. And I get it that Stanton, he's got a lot of potential to do damage. But if I'm not even have some level of confidence that he's going to be back, I'm ready to make a change. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you want to say one place where the rainout could have helped the Yankees in any way, it would be with this, because it did give them an extra day to decide, you know, and that was definitely something that I thought of when the game was called yesterday. But I mean, you just have to imagine with how many days this has gone on now, and the fact that we're in the LCS and they're down a game, that if he can't go today, you know, if he can't be in the lineup, if he can't start, I just don't think they can continue to do this, because it's just affecting the way they would use Edwin Encarnacion and everything else. And as you said, Tauchman was good for them, and this is what the Yankees did all year. You know, I mean, not having Stanton for this series is not the worst thing in the world for them, because they essentially didn't have him for most of the year. And obviously in the back of everyone's mind was the fact that he might be able to be back for the postseason and how much of a boon that would be for them. But at this point, I mean, they won 103 games essentially without him. And I think that they are not going to win or lose this series because of his presence. So they should definitely do what makes them have, you know, the most healthy roster overall.
And Tauchman's a guy who is good at bats. And I'm thinking of when Joe Smith comes into a game to face that string of right-handed hitters. He's a submariner, side-armer guy. I don't mind having that left-handed option on my bench in Tauchman, but we'll know more about that later today. All right, Sarah, enjoy the game.
Thanks, Buster. Have fun.
It's more than just a conversation. It's the Weekly Dish with Keith Law and Bias Cat on Baseball Tonight.
Yeah, Keith Law scouts for ESPN. He writes for ESPN. He's on television for ESPN. And he recently left behind Bias Cat to go watch the Arizona Fall League. Keith, how you doing?
I'm good. Bias Cat is here. I am home. He's right here.
Okay. Well, that's good. And I'm sure he was quite relieved to see you as you came back through the door after seeing the prospects out there. And I just want to start with a simple question. Which player absolutely jumped out to you among that group of prospects that you saw in the Arizona Fall League?
The guy who certainly impressed me the most relative to what I'd seen from him before was Josh Lowe, who was the Rays' first-round pick, I guess, 3 years ago now. He was a third baseman and right-handed pitcher out of Georgia High School, and really scuffled his first two full years in the minors. They'd since moved him to center field. He had a better season this year, and he was absolutely the most impressive. I wouldn't say the best prospect, but he did the most to change my opinion of the player he is and what I saw from him. And it's not that he's other than just sort of getting bigger, he's not that different physically. He's not even that different mechanically, but his at-bats were substantially better. And then the results were there too. He was making a lot of hard contact. He was using the whole field. He did show me some power. He could certainly play the outfield, which I'd heard. That was one thing that when they switched his positions, it seemed like that was an immediate benefit. But I feel a lot better about his ability to hit enough to get to his power and to get on base at a pretty good clip to potentially be, I'd say, an above average regular. He went from a guy who was, arguably not top 10 in the race, very strong farm system coming into the year. And now he's probably a top 100 prospect in all of the minors.
Now, you mentioned the Rays farm system and how strong it is now. Look, the Rays have been a great success story in baseball over the last 15 years, but there was a time, and I think you'll back me up on this, 2010, 2011, 2012, when they had a lot of draft picks and they didn't make a lot of it. In your mind, what has changed for the Rays and why is the farm system in a great place?
They've changed their philosophy in the draft pretty clearly. And there's been some personnel changes there too. Rob Metzler's been their scouting director for a couple of years now, and I think he's had better results since he took over as their scouting director. I think they have probably been a little less unconventional in some of their use of the high picks, and also some of the years that they had all those extra picks too, they ended up having to kind of go under slot, maybe overdraft a few guys just to stay within their budget, which also I think kind of hurt them. So they've been much more productive on the draft side, and that's for both in terms of first round picks, hitting on first round picks, but also continuing into the next few rounds. They've also been a lot more successful on the international front. They've got, obviously we all know about Wander Franco, who's the best prospect in baseball right now, but they've been more successful too with lower dollar figure signings on the international side. And I mean, that is a bit of an underrated or maybe underreported key to building a good farm system. This is why, for example, Baltimore for years just could not build a farm system to compete with the other clubs in the AL East, just because they just ignored the international market entirely.
Yep.
Even if you hit on every draft pick, every high draft pick, you're still not going to be able to keep pace with teams that are effective on the international side.
Right. It's like a presidential candidate saying, I'm going to ignore that entire area of the country.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I never understood that when the Orioles were doing that. And so you're right. I mean, you have to draw from the whole talent pool. You can't just pick one small pool and work from that. And, it always was an Orioles disadvantage. That's changing now. I, of course, have not been out to the Arizona Fall League. And what I like to do are look at the leaderboards and see who's doing well. Tell me about Royce Lewis, who is at the top of some of those leaderboards in terms of the numbers he's putting up.
Yeah, he did hit well when I was out there. I think it was in the fall.
I'm sorry, I should have couched this. Yeah, and I should have couched this. He's a Twins prospect, Royce Lewis.
Yes, and former number one overall pick by 2017, I think that was. He was the first overall pick out of Southern California. He's a shortstop by trade. They've got him in the outfield, which is where I always thought he was going to end up. Well, he's very, very quick. He's at least a 70 runner. He's probably an 80 runner. Certainly underway, he's an 80 runner. But his footwork at shortstop was never very good. I don't think this is a permanent position change yet, but he looked good in the outfield. I think that's ultimately where he's going to end up. Player with his kind of speed is going to profile very well in center field anyway. He did homer in that Fall Stars game, which is the league's, their equivalent of an All-Star game, although the focus, especially this year, was more on let's just get the best prospects in the game as opposed to who had the best first 2 weeks in the Fall League, which I prefer. Let's get the prospects. That's what everyone's here for. He did homer there. He ambushed a first pitch fastball. I still have concerns about the way he hits. He's got a huge leg kick. It's gotten a lot more exaggerated since high school. There's a big hitch in his swing, and he did not hit well at all during the regular season. He had an on-base percentage between high A and double A under 300. So I look at him as he's still a good prospect because the bat speed, the obviously he's got he's coming into some power, the tremendous running speed, it's all still there. but you don't see a lot of big leaguers hit with that noisy of a setup and swing. And I had a lot of scouts say to me this year when they would get, for a lot of them, it was their first look at Royce Lewis, sort of, how does he hit? How is he going to hit with a leg kick that high and a hitch like that? And I think the answer is he's probably not. At some point, the Twins are going to have to work with him to try to minimize that stuff, because he's certainly physically gifted enough to hit. I actually think he could hit for a pretty high average if he quiets everything down.
Yeah, he reached Double A this year, had 127 games in the minor leagues, and he had an on-base percentage of 290, which is always the first number I look at. I don't know it as well as you do, but I always, it's the first number I look at. So to have a 290 on base percentage when you're playing in the minor leagues, that's a concern for me. And it reflects some of what you're talking about. I want to ask you about a couple of the Angels prospects. Joe Adell, we've talked about before, but Brandon Marsh, another Angels prospect, having a good showing in the Arizona Fall League. What'd you see in him?
Yeah. So unfortunately, I did see him. I saw both those guys, and neither guy did much while I was there too. It was funny. I was talking to someone in the Angels front office who saw my write up of the Fall League. He said, "Did you not see Marsh?" I said, "I did. I just didn't see a lot. I saw him make some pretty good contact and not get much to show for it. He had one hit while I was there. He had several hard hit balls. He actually only had one base hit while I was there, where he hit a double out to the right center field gap. And it was probably a single for a lot of players. It was a hustle double for him. I did like the approach. I like the fact that there's a lot of swinging and missing there, just like there is in the majors, right? All these pitchers are throwing hard. Peculiar thing about going to the Fall League now is I look at the sheer number of relievers I see who come in throwing 94, 95, and it's not remarkable. So many of them, I just think, well, he's not really that good a prospect. He just throws hard. Whereas 10 years ago, of course, if you threw 94, 95, immediately everybody was paying attention. Oh, you're clearly a prospect. You're going to get to the big leagues. And I will say, for the best thing I could say about Marsh, and this is also true for Adell too, is that they didn't swing and miss very much. Adell, I think, had only one. I think he only reached base once, and I saw about 10 at bats from him while I was out there. Adell looked great physically. Both guys at least managed to put the ball in play a lot, which, again, just given the frequency of swinging and missing, there were players I saw. I was only out there for 4 days. There were certain guys I saw strike out 4, 5, 6 times. Those guys at least managed to get the bat to the ball, which I think is kind of one of the best indicators you could get from a scouting look. I don't worry too much about, well, this guy didn't get a hit while I was there. It's sort of, how did the at-bats go? Did he show he could catch up to velocity? Did he manage to put the ball in play? Both those guys, without having a lot of results while I was there, did manage to do those things.
Adell's in the big leagues next year. I think we can safely assume that. You know, they've got an option for 2020 on Cole Calhoun. Either they're going to pick up that option and trade him, or they're not going to pick up the option, but they will move on, I'm assuming, from him. How quickly does Brandon Marsh manifest in the big leagues?
I agree with you on Adell, by the way. I think he's definitely in the big leagues next year. Maybe not at the very start, but I would say he spends at least half the year in the big leagues. Marsh could be up in September if they needed him. I would be much more confident saying 2021 for him.
Okay. When I was looking at the numbers in the Fall League, it jumped out to me how few home runs were being hit.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now we're talking so much about the baseball and the conditions.
Right.
What was that about?
Well, so they're using the minor league baseball, right? The Double A and below baseball, not the regular season Major League Baseball. I mean, I feel like we have to qualify everything. What's the Major League Baseball? Well, wait, which Major League Baseball? The regular season baseball or the postseason baseball? This was these were the regular minor league baseballs. And so, For listeners who don't know, too, it's Arizona, right? You're playing at about 1,000 feet above sea level, and the air is dry, and the ball really travels. Typically, there are a lot of home runs there. Generally, the two things you can expect if you go watch a few Fall League games is there'll be a bunch of home runs, and there'll be a bunch of high fly balls that the fielders lose. They talk about the high sky there and that they just have a harder time picking the ball up. Whether that's true or not, I see a lot of dropped pop-ups and fly balls every year I go out there. But you're right, there were not a lot of home runs. I think the other than the baseball, which I would say is the number one factor, the second factor is there's just a lot of swinging and missing now. I saw a ton of strikeouts. think Kevin Smith, the Blue Jays minor leaguer, I think he struck out 5 of 6 plate appearances that I saw from him, and he was not the only one. He just comes to mind right now. You just see, you see a lot more swinging and missing now, which to me would also say if I were in a front office, whether I were an amateur director, pro director, whatever, some, any evaluation focused job, give me the guys who make contact, because it doesn't always have to be results necessarily, but the first thing I would look for is, can they show that they can make contact? Because the fall, like I was saying about the fall league, I have my notebook here. You probably count up. I had to see 20 plus relievers alone who throw 94 plus. And it's not that those guys are all prospects, and it's not that every big leaguer throws 94 plus, but it does seem like a bit of a gating factor. If you show me you can't catch up to 94 as a hitter, it's awfully hard to find a projection for you to be any kind of big league regular. So you have to be able to show you can catch up to that or adjust to that. And then we can go from there and figure out, well, what else can you do? What other skills do you have? But if you can't catch up to what is basically average velocity for a right-hander now, it's going to be tough for you to hit big league pitching because just, almost everybody throws that hard.
All right, you and I over the last couple months have talked about teams and what they should do coming up, because we love to give Major League Baseball executives advice and guidance. And so I want to ask you about a few different situations. We'll start with the Texas Rangers, who will be moving into a new ballpark next spring. They don't have a ton of long-term obligations contractually. Shin-Soo Choo will be in the last year of his contract next year. They've got Elvis Andrus under contract for the next few years. Rougned Odor, and Andrus and Odor at this point, those are contracts that look like they could turn out to be ugly for the team in the last years, but they're not some big ticket items. You would assume that they'll be lying in the weeds this winter in the free agent market, because every team that moves into a new ballpark likes to create some conversation and some juice, which is why I do wonder if in the end they'll wind up making really big offers either to, an Anthony Rendon, a Gerrit Cole, Strasburg, you know, that type of player, if in fact, they're willing to spend some money. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that, I think it makes sense that they, because of the ballpark and because they'll have I think they should have the money to be able to do that. I look at the team right now and think, I don't know that they're really in a competitive position for those moves to make a lot of sense. In other words, I think they go out and sign one of those guys, it certainly makes them a better team to watch, right? They're more competitive next year. Probably does not put them into a playoff spot to add one of those players. Because I look at their farm system now, and after a lot of trades, while they were competing, and then recently they've had some bad injury luck with some of their more important prospects, the system's kind of down. I think it's a below average or below the median farm system right now. It's going to take them a little while to catch back up. And so I don't see the help coming out of the system to turn this team into a real contender in the next, let's say, 2 seasons. They'd have to go out and spend/trade for a couple of significant major league pieces to be able to compete. Now, it's not to say, hey, don't go sign Anthony Rendon. It's obviously, if you get a player like that, you're just immediately better, and then you see if maybe you get lucky. Maybe Rougned Odor has a big bounce back season and becomes the player you thought he was when you gave him that contract. But I think if I were in that front office, I would probably be saying, exercising, being a little more conservative, let's say, with some of these big ticket free agents, just to say, none of these guys is actually going to put us into a playoff berth, whereas there are a lot of other clubs that go sign a Gerrit Cole and you're immediately saying, all right, this team just went from fringe contender to legitimate contender.
And so you're talking essentially about a long play, a broader view.
Yeah.
And by the way, the context is American League West, the Astros right in the middle of their window of being a World Series contender every year, and the Angels ahead of them and the Oakland Athletics ahead of them.
Right. Right. All of that, I think, should weigh into the Rangers' thinking. And again, it's not to say, I'm not advocating any team tank necessarily, and certainly not in the Rangers position, because I don't think that's the right strategy either. But you have to recognize that you got to leapfrog two of those three teams to talk about yourself as a legitimate playoff contender. And I don't think there's a move out there that can do that for them. They're not catching the Astros with one player, certainly. And you have to anticipate that the Angels, especially now with the managerial change, they probably are going to be more aggressive. They're probably going to try to go sign one of those three players you just mentioned. You and I have talked about how Gerrit Cole is such a great fit for the Angels if they're willing to pay for him, and does push them, you know, and they really should be trying to push towards contention with Mike Trout on a long-term deal, obviously playing like one of the best players in baseball history. They have greater incentive to go out and do something like that. So if you're the Rangers, again, it's not to say do nothing, but recognize maybe going out and signing one such player doesn't make as much sense as maybe going out and signing two or three somewhat lesser players, or maybe trading for others where you think you have some untapped upside here. So you're spending less going in and hoping to get lucky or find value in players, you know, the way Tampa Bay did in the trade with Pittsburgh, that got them Austin Meadows and Tyler Glasnow, getting those players, and you get them in, you make some changes and they get better.
Give me 45 seconds on this. How quickly does Seattle become relevant in the American League West?
Yeah, I think we're probably still 3 years away, again, because of the competitive landscape that we just talked about. And also because, you know, for years, Jerry DePoto was trading every prospect he could to try to grab a couple of extra wins at the major league level. It didn't work. He turned things around. He started rebuilding. It takes a couple of years. I think they've done well. I think they've drafted pretty well these last 2 years. They've traded very well. It helped the trade with the Mets, getting Jared Kelenic and Justin Dunn, I think, really helped them. I do think they're at least one, let's say two more good drafts away from becoming really relevant. They could also push things forward a lot with a trade of Mitch Haniger, maybe trading some other major league pieces to continue to add prospects.
And 45 seconds on this one. The Mets are in the process of hiring a manager. Our good friend and colleague Eduardo Perez is one of the people they're talking to. I think he has a chance to be an excellent manager. He's such a great communicator with people, you know, and in our shows, he's always got something going with the cameraman, the production assistant. He really cares about people, and that's an important part of what teams are looking for. That all said, I think if I were in the Mets position, because they're in a win-now mode and they banked so much in 2020, I would bet on a more experienced guy. They're not even going to talk to Buck Showalter, apparently, which I don't understand. But if I were them, I probably would hire Joe Girardi based on how much that they bet on next season. What about you?
Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. I think Eduardo would do a good job. I think also if you look at some of the places he's worked so far, too. He's got varied experiences working with different front offices and different coaching staff. So he's got, I think any experience like that potentially makes you more valuable going, especially going to kind of a muddled situation like the Mets too, where it's not clear what the, how much input, for example, R&D is having on what the manager is doing. But like you, I thought all along, one, I thought they'd get an experienced manager, and two, I expected them to go get a bigger name manager. It just seems like they're the Mets and their headline and the owners are very headline conscious, and they're going to go hire someone who's kind of famous. And that's not necessarily to say that that's the best guy. I'm saying I think that's what they'll end up doing. In Girardi's case, they'd get a pretty good manager who's also pretty famous, particularly famous in New York, and is probably a good fit for a team that's trying to win immediately.
And as I said on New York radio yesterday, for us to try to predict what the Mets are going to do is probably folly, because a year ago, who would have guessed that the general manager would be an agent who has zero experience in that job?
Right.
Who knows what the Mets are going to do? Keith, thanks for doing this.
Yep, my pleasure.
Bleacher Tweets.
First tweet this morning comes from Don Irvine, at Don Irvine. Based on his NLCS stats, Patrick Corbin seems to be the weak link in the Nationals' rotation. Will he be able to turn himself around, or are we likely to see more Gio Gonzalez-like performances in the World Series?
Yeah, I think he could turn himself around. Absolutely. Now, I would say this. I mean, I think one thing that Patrick Corbin has demonstrated is that he's going to be a high pitch count guy, especially when facing the elite hitters of October. So you may not necessarily see him, you know, throw into the seventh inning. That'll be the day when the Nationals will especially have to rely on their bullpen to get through the last innings.
Speaking of pitching, P.K. Steinberg at P.K. Steinberg wants to know, would a Houston-Washington World Series feature the most incredible pitching matchup of all time in the World Series?
Yeah, it would be tremendous. Now, of all time, I don't know. You know, I was thinking back of some of the, you know, the great World Series that we've seen where teams were lining up, you know, great starters. For example, you think back in the 60s when you had a young Jim Palmer going up against the Sandy Koufax, some of those Orioles and Mets rotations from 1969. From 2001, you had Curt Schilling, Randy Johnson on one side. You had Roger Clemens, Andy Pettit, and Mike Messina on the Yankees on the other side. But this rotation matchup, if Houston advanced, it would be terrific.
Yeah, definitely can't wait for that. If that is the case, here's the next one from The Foolish Club at Foolish Club. Washington has a historically bad bullpen. The Mets and Cubs missed the playoffs because of theirs. And Joe Kelly and Kenley Jansen were a vulnerability for the Dodgers. And he listed a few more examples of bad bullpens. So what's going on? Do relievers just suck now?
No, not all of them. I mean, shoot, you know, after when I was in Houston last week, you know, to listen to George Springer and Jose Altuve talk about the Rays bullpen, they were in awe. Like, they love the Rays bullpen, and they were talking, Altuve said to me, Diego Castillo had the best stuff of any pitcher that he faced this year. And if you remember, in one of those games in that series, Castillo started as an opener, and Altuve said to me, I was, like, glad that he started as an opener, because then I didn't have to worry about him the rest of the game. So they're definitely good relievers. We definitely saw that from the Rays.
Last one comes from Amy Chapman at Amy Art Chapman. Hey, Buster and Troy. Has the postseason changed your views on who should win the MVP, Cy Young, and other awards?
No, Amy, as a point of rule that you have with these awards, the writers who vote in them are actually required to turn in their ballots within 24 hours after the end of the regular season. So the votes have already been cast for all those major awards, and nothing that happens in the postseason affects the winners of those.
As a follow-up, when we had Tim on the podcast earlier this summer, I think you guys had discussed your voting and how Tim only gets to vote for MVP like in 1 year. Like, you guys rotate your votes and what you can vote for. Is that correct?
Yeah, and to be clear, I have not voted since 1996. So I don't vote. Tim is in a chapter in the Washington, I think it's the Washington-Baltimore chapter, where what happens is the chapter chairman essentially assigns votes. And so in a given year, he'll say, okay, Tim, this year you're going to vote on American League Cy Young Award. Tim, this year you're going to vote on National League Cy Young Award. Tim, you get the MVP vote this year. This year you get Rookie of the Year Award. He has a vote every single year. I've been in the New York chapter since I joined ESPN, and I've never been assigned a vote.
That is unfortunate. Maybe one day I'll get a vote. Thank you for sending us the
You're not in a chapter. Well, you're not part of the baseball writer. Step aside.
Well, put me in one, the Connecticut chapter. Thank you for the tweets this morning. Keep them coming every day. Rena Bonino has you tomorrow. Use the hashtag Bleacher Tweets.
That's it for today. My thanks to Chris Singleton, to Sarah Langs, and to Keith Law, and to Troy Farkas, who will be reading something very spiritual this evening in the run-up to Game 4, Astros and Yankees. Remember, you can listen to that on ESPN Radio. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.